What about the tension between paganism and monotheism? Like, that's a kind of a big question. Maybe it's like too large of a question, but I think it relates to Shabtai Tzvi and his, let's say, trying to integrate paganism into Kabbalah, into the tradition, right?
But let's go there, Brother Andrew. But I want to first just step back, because again, we're in very, this is a very special space. So we get to kind of be just kind of like, in Hebrew, there's a word adasof, go all the way. There's very few places we can go all the way. So I want to just ask a question just to check in. Mm-hmm. I'm going to check on myself. So correct me if I got anything wrong here. So I'm just, this is a genuine, sincere question. Was my full honor and love of both Bonnie and Jordan fully apparent in what I said? I hope it was. I just want to check in that it was. Okay. So I want to make sure that it was, because this was full honoring. Mm-hmm. This is full loving. That's what real honor and love is. We go head to head, but with this deep respect. And that's what we have to be able to do, right? In other words, there wasn't, you know, and I want to check in with kind of Claire and Simona and my friends, right? Did y'all felt the full honor and love in that? Full honor, full love, full respect, right?
And also, you know, that there's differences and there are tensions, and that's yeah. fine, and within the honor and respect. And even very animated ones, let's say.
That's right. And we can be fierce, you know, and Bonnie, you know, who kind of came into the seminar, you know, kind of like with the whole narrative, you know, in her mind, as she shared with me in her walk, and she shared in the public space, and it was recorded, so I can cite it. You know, and she began the seminar in a quite dramatic way. And, you know, and I responded with, you know, with a kind of, you know, enormous open heart and gentle fierceness and tenderness. And we found our way in a very deep way, right? We can actually be respectful and fierce and tender at the same time. And that's what I'm thinking. It's, we need to create a new quality of discourse, right? Which is not a kind of homogenized pluralism, but which is also not an egoic self-branding. And both of those, right? Both of those are not the way we need to go. We need to synergize and do something new. So, okay. Yeah. So somebody wrote
love differences. And I think that's...
Yeah, love differences, you know, and who Kathy Brownbuck wrote, who's actually a great educator and a dear and great, you know, I mean, Kathy's unbelievable. Right? And I want to just add something. And there's a hierarchy of differences. So I want to make this really clear, make it really sharp. I am sure that I'm right about this. And that I don't think that Bonnie and I are equally right about it, even slightly. Right. So I want to be very clear. I'm not being pluralistic here. Right. Right. I think the notion that you throw lineage out is insane. I don't even think Bonnie believes it. Right. Right. So this is not kind of, this is not, oh, right, all religions are the same, all differences. This is not a kind of liberal pluralism. That's what liberal pluralism, right, means basically no one believes in anything. So that therefore we respect all differences as being equal. No, we respect all differences that are come to through fierce contestation, through a full life, right, of mad passion, dedication, and study, and then, which I think all of us have done, right? And then from there, we actually have to try and affirm. So I'm convinced, right, that actually the position I just articulated is correct, and that if Bonnie and I actually sat down, we would agree on it. If we actually sat down for real and went back and
forth. Yeah, I mean, I don't think she believes that, what you've just characterized her as believing. I think she has a different, maybe more... Maybe it's more like that something from some older lineages have to come and get rid of the or overcome the newer overcome the more reified rigid you know lineages which are dying, and so there has to be this constant, you know, renewal.
That's not how you presented the position. That's not how Bonnie presented the position. That's what I believe. What you just said now is what I believe. Well, give me a second. What you just said now is what I believe Bonnie believes. And I agree with that 1,000%. So let's say that then. In other words, what we all agree is that we need to explode. And this brings us to Shabtai Tzvi. Actually, what Shabtai Tzvi was about, if you want to get who Shabtai Tzvi was at the very core, like if we're going to cut through and Shalom scholarship. And I brought a bunch of quotes from you from manuscripts. I mean, some incredible Shabtai Tzvi kind of, you know, which I'm going to bring to the table today. But if you cut through, you know, Gershom Scholem in the book that Andrew showed us at the beginning, is it still on the table there?
Right. Yep.
There it is. Right. It is. Right. This was shot. That's just book one, where he gathers an enormous amount of information about this mystical Messiah, right? The core of Shabtai Tzvi, and maybe we should retell the story a little bit, but maybe we'll start at the end and then go to the beginning. The core of Shabtai Tzvi actually is the position that Bonnie and I completely agree on, and Jordan agrees on, and Zach agrees on, and Andrew, I think you agree on, mm-hmm. although we come from different parts of it, which is we need to cleanse and purify and clarify the tragedy and the dross of the old lineages that got caught, that got stale, right? That got reified. And from that explosion and clarification come to a new authenticity. But then we need to integrate the best of that into a new shared story of value, which is the beginning of a new lineage that itself should be challenged. But in other words, we have to live inside of a story of value in which value is real. And Shabtai Tzvi lives in an age in which you could not be a human being without living in the structure of a lineage, a religion. You weren't, there was no such thing as an individual. Didn't exist, right? You were Christian, or you were Muslim, or you were Jewish, right? Or you were, right, you were completely defined. And Shabtai Tzvi literally, Andrew, he literally seeds modernity, right? I'd say that he and Spinoza's the known figure, Shabtai's the unknown figure.
Totally unknown figure, yeah.
Totally unknown figure, but he literally says, no, you have direct relationship, which is personal and intimate, to source. And Shabtai, right, is in modernity, he births the Renaissance. Right. He when I say he births, I don't mean it historically exactly, but he's an expression. And he says, no. It's not true that I can only be Jewish or Muslim or Christian. He talks about what he talks about. He says, Elohai Shabtai Tzvi. He says, there's the God of Shabtai. He says, it's my God. And my God, I have a personal relationship to. And that relationship is not mediated through law. Right. And it's not mediated through ritual. And it's not mediated through a political establishment, and it's not mediated through a religious establishment. I have a direct and intimate, uniquely individuated relationship, right, to the divine. That was an explosive idea.
What's different than Martin Luther's sort of, you know, the Protestant Reformation? Where's the difference there?
Well, first off, let's point to your first. Your implicit statement, which is there's a deep analogy. Mm-hmm. First up, the way in which they're similar. That's one, right? But now, where's different? Luther remains with the notion that ultimately, right, there is no redemption outside of the church. But it's a new church. It's a Protestant church, right? But ultimately, without the church or without faith, right? And when I have faith, there's the church, the Catholic Church, or there's faith. And faith means you have to have direct personal faith in a particular dogmatic construct. And without that, you cannot be redeemed. But that's not a possibility, right? That's not a possibility. The possibility that actually you can actually have independent dignity, and that dignity, right, gives you the capacity, right, to self-transform. But that you actually are not just saved by faith in Jesus, but that you actually are an individual, right, in whom the powers of evolution move, in whom the powers of Eros move, and that you have the ability to evolve, to transform, to learn, right, to become noble, right, to become different than you were at the point of origin. All those possibilities for Luther and human dignity don't exist. Right. And as he breaks with the church, but he replaces the church with kind of classical dogmatic faith. He replaces the church with dogmatic faith. Shabtai replaces the church with what? With the dignity of the individual who is an intimate relationship with source, which is utterly unmediated. Those are entirely different. It's a big deal. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense, brother?
Sure. But I was thinking about how just the tension between, again, the law, right? And then the fact that this character is such a heretic to the law, such an intense heretic to the law. And I was wondering, could there be a heretic that was actually, the heretic is actually the Messiah or something in this case?
The heretic is the Messiah. So let's go into Shabtai for a second, because I think I'm getting the sense, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm getting the sense that we're assuming a lot of knowledge about Shabtai, and there's a lot of people that are new, and even last week we didn't. So maybe if it's okay, let me just take a step back and share a little bit about Shabtai so people get just even a couple of minutes, get a sense of what are we talking about here. So Shabtai Tzvi, right, is this unimaginably charismatic figure. I mean, you can't even imagine it, right? So in other words, he's not a fringe figure. This is really important. Andrew, you and I know this, and you've studied Shalom's work. So, and that's very apparent in his work. He's not a fringe figure. The major masters of the time align with Shabtai. And they basically says he is the Messiah. So there's a tradition of a Messiah, right, in the Hebrew wisdom tradition. Jesus is an expression of that tradition, right? The next major expression of it, although there's others along the way, the next major expression of it is Shabtai. Yeah. Shabtai is a major messianic figure who's not adopted by the rabble, right? The overwhelming majority of the Hebrew wisdom community, right, from Greece, right, to what's today Serbia, to Africa, to Asia, right? In other words, right, goes with him, so much so that until his conversion to Islam, which we're going to talk about in a second, until that conversion, if you didn't believe Shabtai was the Messiah, you did not say that out loud, because you could lose your job, you could be subject to attack, right? You actually went underground. So I want to get what's happening here. And they said that, by the way, the major way that he had a prophet named Nathan of Aza, as you know. Right, the prophet, right, his prophet Nathan was this major figure who kind of formulated the philosophy, but Shabtai was the embodiment of the God force. And so, for example, I just want to give you an example. At the key moment in his life, he was arrested by the Sultan. He was imprisoned by the Sultan of Turkey, Ottoman Empire, and you know, his prison gets turned into kind of like his palace. And there's some moment who's supposed to meet the Sultan, and he tells everyone that he's going to meet the Sultan. And, you know, he doesn't have a political program. He's not it's not a political messianic program. He's not trying to liberate the Jews. He's trying to liberate God. He's trying to liberate. He calls it the liberation of emunah, the liberation of faith, liberation of trust. He calls it the liberation of emunah, which is literally the liberation of trust. So it's not a political program for the Jews, right? His entire political program, by the way, was he's going to meet the Sultan. The Sultan's going to hear him sing. You ready for this? The Sultan's going to be so moved by his singing, he's going to make Shabtai, right, the Sultan, and the Sultan will serve him. And then once he's the Sultan, he'll free the Jews from being oppressed. But that's kind of a side issue, right? In other words, and Shabtai's completely convinced this is going to happen, and not because he's crazy, because that's what's happened his whole life. People come into contact with him, Andrew, and he sings.
Yeah.
And he pours forth. He pours forth spirit. He's fully alive, and you sense the God force and the goodness of the God force moving in him. And there are attestations, and I'm going to share with you a book. This is a virtually unknown book written by Ada Rappaport, who I knew a little bit. She passed away, but not, you know, when I was at Oxford, I spoke to her a little bit. And the first chapter of this book, it's called Women and the Messianic Heresy of Shabtai Tzvi, like an unknown book, like six people have read it. It's fantastic. You read chapter one, right? And pick this up, everyone. Read chapter one and read just the accounts of people who are just prophecy. They encounter Shabtai Tzvi, they hear his song, and they're utterly transformed, right? And then they don't just prophecy, but they actually go into subtle texts of Kabbalah and mysticism and philosophy, and they give new interpretations to the text, and they're flowing, right, with new dharma and new wisdom. So this wild major figure, right? Now, what does Shabtai do? So he does four things. One, he says, I'm going to stand against the oppression of women. So there's a certain moment in his life. It's actually after he converted to Islam, and I'll talk about that conversion in a second, where he goes into a synagogue and he goes and calls women to read the Torah. At a moment, proto-feminism, right? Nothing's even vaguely appeared. And he said, oh my God, that verse in the Bible, which says that your v'hu yimshol bach, he shall rule over you, which is after the Garden of Eden story, he says, that's a curse. That's not the nature of reality. Women, liberate yourselves, right? We need the ascension of the feminine. And that he was expressing a deep theme in Luranic Kabbalah, but which was an abstract theme, and he made it real, and he stood for the liberation of the feminine. That's one.
Right. Two. So maybe you can talk a little bit more about that, because about that principle of the Shekhinah, or liberating the feminine.
Maybe let's go one at a time. That's great.
That'd be great. Great to.
Let's do one at a time, because he had four principles. Let's do one at a time. I love that. Okay. So first off, and so again, for those who are kind of tracking, we're going to get back to Shabtai's meeting with the Sultan and what happened. We'll get back to that. Okay, we're kind of on our way there. And so we're now talking, Andrew and Mark, we're talking about, you know, what did he actually stand for? Like, who was he? So the first thing he stands for, we're talking about this liberation of the feminine. So in Luriana Kabbalah, which is so crazy gorgeous, right? Right? And so subtle and so hard to read, right? If anyone who's read Integral Theory is like the easiest thing to read compared to Luranic Kabbalah. It's a very subtle, complex. And so in Luranic Kabbalah, there's a hidden, well, not hidden, hidden if you're not reading carefully, but once you read carefully, it's very clear, called Aliyat HaNukva, the ascension of the feminine. And the ascension of the feminine is about fixing the degradation of the feminine, which Luria locates in the moment in which the sun and the moon in the original creation story are supposed to be equal lights. And then, so in the text, you see there's sun and moon. And then there's some moment in which the sun clearly becomes dominant and the moon becomes in devotion to the sun, but the moon loses its power. That appears in the Genesis text if you read it carefully. The sun is understood as the masculine, in mythic terms, the moon, the feminine. And this prioritizing at a certain moment in history of the masculine, although perhaps necessary, right, is viewed by Luria as something like what modern feminism calls patriarchy. It's viewed by Luria as an utter violation of the nature of reality. And so therefore, what needs to happen is the masculine and the feminine are actually, they need to turn away from each other. They need to individuate. And Luria describes seven stages of Aliyat HaNukva, of the ascension of the feminine. And in my I have a volume called Radical Kabbalah in volume two, which is about the wisdom of Solomon. If you look at the index, I go through the original Lurianic sources and the Zohar sources, the Aramaic sources about this notion, right? The emergence of the feminine. But for Luria, that's a theoretical, mystical, right, interior process. Shabtai says, no. Shabtai says, let's make this real, right? The feminine needs to claim her fullness. Now, that's part one, but here it gets crazy. And then turn back to here's part two. It gets completely crazy, Andrew. And part of the fullness of the feminine is the fullness of her fuck, the fullness of her eros, right? Right. And Luria actually works very hard to actually say that Lilith, who is the she-demon, because she's lost this radical sexuality. If you read Luria carefully, which I did with an old friend of mine, and we published a Hebrew book that we're now about to republish on 2,000 years of texts about Lilith, right? Luria reclaims Lilith into the precincts of the sacred and says that Lilith actually, this she-demon Lilith is actually the first Eve. The second Eve is the kind of, you know, expression of the feminine through the eyes of patriarchy, but Lilith is the full power of the radicalized erotic feminine, which the church also recognized, which is why, but the church demonized, right, feminine desire. The church says feminine desire is insatiable and wild and way beyond any kind of dimension of masculine desire. And my old colleague David Data, right? David writes about this a lot, right? The kind of the radical, gorgeous nature of feminine desire that far exceeds masculine desire. The church demonizes it. Luria reclaims the feminine and says, no, 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 Lilith, radical feminine desire needs to be in the precincts of the sacred. And then Shabtai turns to the feminine and to the masculine, but to the feminine to lead, and says to the feminine, right, live the fullness of your desire and reclaim its utter purity. Mm-hmm. Whoa, right? Like, whoa, we're in the 17th century. And he does this, Andrew, through radical acts of boundary breaking, which I won't go into now, but they're radical boundary breaking acts. But that's his second move.
So this,
go ahead.
Sorry, this might be where you join with Bonita's kind of view of this hyper-paganism that needs to come back.
This is, well, I would say, let me just say clear, I'm going to be really clear here, right? Right? In other words, Shabtai was a broken figure. He was filled with brokenness, right? And we're all filled with the holy and broken, hallelujah, but Shabtai was not a figure to be imitated. Shabtai was not a clean, pure teacher, right? And now every clean, pure teacher has faults and flaws. We're all imperfect vessels for the light. But Shabtai was more than that. Shabtai was actually wildly expansive and then wildly broken. He would both close and then open. Right? Actually, when he goes to the Sultan, right, the meeting doesn't go well because actually he's in a madly depressed state when he goes and he's not in an open state. One of the reasons the meeting doesn't go well. So Shabtai is not a figure to be emulated. And Shabtai is basically having women sleep with their brothers, right? He's having, you know, women sleep with their sons, right? In other words, he's breaking every boundary, right, in the most radical way. So clearly, right, neither I or Bonnie, right, are on board with that kind of radical boundary breaking. What we are on board with is, I think, and I can't speak for Bonnie, but we are on board with the reclaiming of what we might call the purity of fuck, the goodness of Eros, right? The realization that the tumescence of the feminine and the throbbing of the masculine, right, is actually an expression of the cosmoerotic universe in person, awake and alive in me, which is utter purity, right? The purity of that, the goodness of that. So Shabtai, in this radical anarchic way, breaks every vessel, right, without any containment in order to point towards that truth. And vessels shatter and enormous suffering is caused. And yet it opens something up. So he's one of those figures, right, who was in some sense a messianic figure and that he changed, but not a messianic figure in the sense that he was perfect or that he got everything right, but that he actually changed the course of human spiritual history, right? And he actually had the sense. So if you actually read deeply the sources around the temple, you know, and I wrote an article, it was actually a cover story in a magazine called Tikkun, which is an intellectual magazine in America in 2002 or three. I wrote an article called On the Erotic and the Ethical, which was about the hidden neo-pagan sources in the actual Aramaic texts. So for example, Moshe Cordovero, Luria's teacher, who says Astarte is the Shekhinah. Astarte, Asherah, is the Shekhinah who needs to be reinstated in the temple. And if you look at my book, Mystery of Love, it has a kind of picture on the cover of a kind of Asherah, Astarte tree. And we cite Cordovero, right? So in other words, the temple, right, actually was an expression of this sense of the purity of the radical aliveness, not of sexing, but of the fuck of cosmos, of the eros of cosmos, which in one expression incarnates in our body. And what Shabtai is saying is, although he goes too far because he's breaking all the vessels, but what he gets right at the core is I've got to be able to trust my body. And it's if I can't trust that the surging force of Eros in my body, when it's clarified, not in its pseudo form, not in its sloppy form, but the clarified Eros in my body, if I can't trust the goodness of that, then I'm lost in shame. Right? Because I'm trying to be this good social person. I'm trying to be this good obedient person, this good religious person. Then I've got this surging force of eros that moves, that demands, that allures me. That's this raging, pulsing desire. Right? So if I can't actually recognize that desire is the nature of cosmos, desire is the nature of she, and that desire lives uniquely as me, and that to be a unique self is to be a unique configuration of desire. And I can't actually live that desire in my body according to and in accordance with my own unique script of desire. Right? If I can't access my unique script of desire, my unique script of desire either hijacked or demonized and degraded by the churches, the old lineages, or the new pornographic lineages, which tell me what I should desire, if I can't access that desire, then I can't trust myself. That's what we're saying. So Shabtai, he goes too far. He breaks all the vessels. Breaks all the vessels. And I want to be really clear about that, right? In other words, right? And he's pointing towards something. And so he's saying, women, arise. And part of arising is claim the purity of your tumescence, the goodness of your fuck, the Lilith that lives inside of you, you know, and merge the raging quality of your desire with the fierce tenderness of your nurturing, right? Which is, you know who you are. The church demonized that. The old lineages demonized that. No, that's authentic. That's true. That's holy. Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, it's like, it is wow. And it's like, yes, but then why is this so hard for people to understand? Or why does the church continue to demonize the fuck?
I mean, should we get like crazy real about this? Let's get crazy real about this, okay? So let's talk, Andrew, about that sexual experience you had. Remember 13 years ago? Remember that one? I'm just making this up. I was making that up, right? But the point is, we laugh at it, but we can all access it, right? And what we just did is kind of a little pointing out moment, right? We all know that moment 13 years ago, or 17 years ago, or when I was 17, or when I was 19, or right, or that moment that didn't happen that I wanted to happen. In other words, you know, it's that aspirational moment that actually never happened. And so we all have a dimension of our desire that we haven't clarified, that actually rages in us. And so actually what lives in us is both our unfulfilled desire, our unclarified desire. We haven't actually clarified our desire. We haven't fulfilled our desire. We haven't incarnated the purity of our desire, right? And yet we have this knowing inside of us that there's some full expression of my fully embodied desire that is so holy and so pure that if I could live that in the fullness of its pleasure, in which pleasure becomes pure ethics, pure ethos, where I literally am cosmorotic humanism in person, right? Where I am divine desire in person, that is sufficient reason to be alive. And that every human being has a right to that, but we don't get there. We don't get there. So we're lost in these unclarified desires because we don't even have a story of clarified desire. We live in stories of demonized desire. We live in sexual narratives that are partial and broken. We don't even have a story of desire, which is what we're trying to do in part in cosmorotic humanism. It's one of the five vectors, is to actually retell a story of desire that is both rooted in the interior and exterior sciences. We have no story like that. So we're actually split off from that which is our very essence, which is the desire that lives in us. But it's not just the desire that lives in us. It's the yearning for that unique incarnation of desire that we want exploded in us that makes our lives self-evidently good, true, and beautiful. We know it's there. We can't access it. So we're shamed for either the ways we've acted it out that weren't as full or sacred as they could have been, or we're shamed by the fact that we never got to act it out, that we never got to. So we're shamed by our desire. We're shamed by our lack of fulfillment of our desire. We're shamed by our broken expressions of our desire. And we have no narrative of desire to live in. And desire is the core essence and structure of reality. Well, that could do it.
Okay, got it.
That could do it, right?
There's a problem with the programming somewhere.
Right, and there's an essential broken source code. The source code is broken. Reality is desire, and we have no source code of desire. It's broken at the very core. So at least the church, here's the thing. The church for the most part, goes with either a sex negative vision of desire, the classical church, or the kind of more liberal Protestant or Jewish or et cetera, goes with what I would call either a sex neutral or a sex positive, a kind of bland sex positive, or at best, we'll go with sex sacred because it creates babies, right? It creates life. None of those are sufficient. Those natters of desire won't take us home, right? So sex, it's not sacred because it creates life. Sex is sacred because it is life. It's one expression, not the only one, but it's one potent expression of the very currency of eros and desire that cosmos is. And therefore, the sexual models the erotic. And all the dimensions of the erotic are available in the sexual. The sexual becomes, right, actually, when it's clarified, right, the ultimate guide, right, to the depth, right, of knowing, which is why the lineage masters wrote, Andrew, right, that if none of the books of wisdom were given, we could actually adjudicate all of wisdom based on reading the Song of Solomon, which is a book that is purely erotic pornographic. It's explicit sexual description, right? Love notes, outrageous erotic love notes between a lover and a beloved. All right. And the text in the Mishnah and Yadayim, third century, chapter 3, Mishnah 5, right, alludes to and points to this knowing, if none of the wisdom books were available, we just have the Song of Solomon, right? All ethics, right? Everything would come from there. Without that, we literally can't trust our own interior. And the second you cut a person off from their ability to trust their own interior, you create the beginning of totalitarianism, beginning of tyranny. So he can't quite say all this, but he feels this and he just goes to kind of draw. Like that's what he goes. He explodes everything. And yet there was so much God in him that until he converts, the entire community goes with him. And so it's true that the entire community is not quite aware of the extent of the practices, but they know something's going on. And the leading rabbis, they know something's going on. And he's just so filled with the God force, right? That they go with him. But because he was at a moment in which if you left your religious structure, you left God. So for the Jewish community, just like for the Christian community or for the Muslim community of the time, to leave your religious structure is to not exist. Shabtai is saying no, right? The crisis of his conversion, for him, that's exactly the point he's making. He's saying, no, I'm not just Jewish. I read Hafiz, I'm not just a Jew, I'm not just a Muslim, I'm not just a Christian, right? I'm an intimate lover of the divine. So for him, he's saying, hey, I can do the Muslim thing. And actually, in some sense, he's a proto-universalist. And everyone experiences it as betrayal. But actually, he goes and lives in Montenegro, right? He's exiled to Montenegro in the end. And actually, by all accounts, he lives out his life in practice, right? You know, surrounded by people, right? Deeply in love with the divine, experienced as the ultimate betrayal by his community, and yet somehow living out and incarnating a future reality in which, like Spinoza, he explodes the lineages that Bonnie and myself, right, and Dak and Jordan so correctly say we need to explode in order to create the new lineage together. Right, but we got to take the best of the old. Mm-hmm. That's a lot, my friend. I just got this sense. I just got this early childhood sense. I just want to apologize to everyone. I get that I'm too much, so I apologize. I just got the sense of my mother's mark. Just
oh no,
right? I just got this early childhood sense of being just too much. Okay, so I'll shut the fuck up, please.
No, yeah, I'm a little speechless today before all this, shocking. But
there's no words.
But it is shocking. You're mentioning the first one was the rectification of the feminine. What was the second one? And there's second a third one and a fourth one, right?
Reclaiming of the purity of fuck.
Right.
The purity of Eros. Two, three. Okay, three. Three would be. Right. Three is the liberation of the human being from within the mediated contexts of identity, which means religion, nationality. No, I have a direct, ultimately intimate personal relationship with source. That's three. Okay, that's three. That's three. Four. Okay, and the fourth is the liberation of, say this the right way. I would call it the liberation of courage, right? In other words, Shabtai is willing, right, to go to jail. He's willing to give it all up, right? He's actually able to locate himself in this deep interiority from which wells unimaginable confidence, because he's drinking directly from the well, and he is the well, and he refuses to back down, right? And so he's utterly shattered, and yet he lives in joy, right? And if I can, with permission, you know, Andrew, every once in a while, you know, I encounter some version of critique or attack, you know, usually by people, you know, who I don't know or have kind of certain kinds of agendas that are low and hidden. And I've experienced it for 20, 30 years, 40 years. It's just the nature of being a certain kind of person. And you would think that I developed a thick skin, like a big deal, just another one. So I have succeeded not once in ever developing a thick skin, right? And that's, my skin is about as thin as it comes, meaning I'm hurt anew every time someone says something that's preposterous. Like, really? Like, really? And then, like, for 2 days, I'm like sad about it, right? So, and then I find Shabtai, right? And I say, fuck, the dude was completely excommunicated, right? Right, completely cut off, and yet he lived in his interior center. And so I think you don't want to develop a thick skin, because if you actually develop a thick skin and you're not affected by how people hold you, right, then you actually lose connection to your humanity. I never want to have a thick skin. I want to be hurt by everything, and yet don't want to lose my courage. Meaning, I don't want to change course. You get the difference? I don't want to change course. I'm not going to change course. I'm not going to play to that choir. I'm not going to read scripts that people ask me to read. I want to stay madly courageous. And so that's the fourth thing Shabtai did. He liberated the sense of, you know, how did Laertes, what was it? Polonius to Laertes, Laertes to Polonius. I'm forgetting my figures in Shakespeare, right? Above all, to thine own self be true, right? You know, and that canst be false to any man, right? So the sense of that I actually can trust that clarified sense that calls me forth, and I can live in it even when all seems lost, and I can live in radical joy. That's the fourth thing that Shabtai did. And it's a very big deal, meaning it's not the new age thing as, oh, no one can make you feel bad. You make yourself feel bad. That's bullshit. People can make you feel bad all the time. Of course they can. That's why we take people seriously. Reality is a relationship. And yet, I hold my center, right? And I can be faithful to that center. I can trust that center. So I can actually say, this is the fourth thing personally, I trust myself, right? I'm confident. I hope not arrogant, and I ask people to challenge me all the time. I'm confident in that Sabbatian sense. I trust and check myself again and again and again, but in the end, I know I can trust that. It's the one that's never let me down. And that belongs to every human being. And it's not a surface quality. Andrew Sweeney can truly trust Andrew Sweeney. And here's the thing, the last piece, then back to you. This is the fourth thing. And if Andrew Sweeney can fully trust Andrew Sweeney, then Mark can trust Andrew Sweeney. That's the thing. And if Mark can't fully trust Mark, then Andrew can't trust Mark. Right? In other words, when we become trustable to ourselves, then we stop being betrayers. Judas doesn't trust himself, so he betrays Jesus. Right? I've got to actually trust that underneath all of the self-loathing and all of the shame, I can actually find the purity of my eros and its unique script of desire and know that is a text of revelation, and that is true. And we can democratize that. That's available to every human being. That's the new human, right? That's what we're staking our lives on. That is possible. And that's what Skinner didn't know was true. It's what the MIT Media Lab doesn't know what is true. And all the movements today, and Elon Musk doesn't believe, right? It's once you say that the human being lives outside the field of value and that the human being is merely material and that matter is merely material, and there is no field of value, there's no reason to trust human beings. Why would you trust human beings? Therefore, you have to control them, because if you don't control them, we're gonna blow the whole fucking thing up. But to actually trust human beings is to know that I am in the field of value and I am in the field of eros, and that ultimately I can cultivate my identity as being a unique expression of that field, and that's trustable, so I become a trustworthy person. Like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting you would say that about, as we're talking about Shabtai Tzvi, who would be sort of the figure of, who created a lot of fear. I mean, like, you know what I mean? Of people thought that he was, the false Messiah. So is there a way that this mad joy you're talking about is intimately related with the ability to take on the suffering of others at the same time? Is that what it is?
It's part of it, right? So let's be in this together, okay? Let's be in this together. Isaiah, right, that great master who was so important to early Christianity and to the formation of the notion of Christos, right? Isaiah says, right, kind of feeling he kind of incarnates the intimations of she in cosmos, and he says, "Bekol tzaratam lo tzar," right? In all of your pain, I'm in pain with you, which becomes the source of Christos, right? Right, and it's why Jesus is such a powerful figure. I'm nailed on the cross for you. I suffer your suffering. So if I can't suffer in your suffering, I can't take joy in your joy, right? Right, I can't be blown open by your sensuality, right? I can't feel the depth of your explosion if I can't feel the depth of your pain. And we don't want to feel the depth of anyone else's pain, not even our own. Right. And so the capacity, I would say, not to feel the depth of someone that's suffering, but just to feel the depths of someone, both their suffering and their joy. And I want to just, if I can, offer a direct practice, which I practice myself often. And the practice is very simply be with the beloved, man, woman, or small mammal, right? Man, woman, or some fluid version of that is sometimes easier than small mammal, although not always. Right. And don't look in each other's eyes and love each other. That's you start. But then look in each other's eyes or close your eyes and actually feel. I want to feel what you're feeling. So when I, and again, I, this is, and this is, there's a quality that you have, Andrew, which evokes trust in me. So I generally on this podcast say too much. Right. I always regret slightly afterwards, right? So, but I'll just say too much for a second. So when I'm talking to Andrew, right, I'm not thinking this consciously. It's just what I'm just doing is I'm trying to feel you. And there's moments when I can feel you very clearly. I can actually literally feel inside you feeling, or I disappear and I can feel and hear you. So there was a little moment when we mentioned your kids where something in your heart just kind of burst. I could just hear it, the burst and this feeling inside of you, which just like burst into my heart and just kind of like melted me for a moment. I had to catch myself in order to kind of not lose right? The flow, right? But when I actually step, I bracket me, right? And I'm not falling in love with you in the sense of just adoration. Oh my God, you're so beautiful. The movement of your belly and the curve of your breast and the, right? Now they go masculine to feminine, feminine to masculine, right? Your beauty just blows me away. That's beautiful, but that's step one. Step two is I can feel you. I can feel you, right? And there's someone who I worked very closely with for many, many years. And we were very close. We did, you know, thousands of Holy of Holies. And then someone in this person's family became sick, right? And then we worked together for several years in that sickness. And actually it blew my heart open because I could feel that person in an entirely new way. And it's not loving that person, but feeling them on the inside. So once you feel another person on the inside, which is not easy because you have to actually bracket yourself. You have to become completely non-instrumental. I just want to feel how you're feeling on the inside. What does it feel like to be Andrew on the inside? I'm just do that for a second. Now I'm not Mark anymore. I'm feeling, and I need Andrew's permission to do that, right? Because I need his permission just for a second, right?
It's or granted. Yes.
Right? Right? So I want to feel, I am now Andrewness. Right? And I just want to notice, like, there's a temptation that arises from the ego self to say something funny now, because it's such a serious thing to do, you know, right? But actually, when I disappear and I feel you, or when you disappear and you feel me, means we've left the place of separate self. We've entered the field, the God field, the field of she, which we both live in together. And we actually, from that field, we don't lose, right? It's not, I'm not gone. It's Mark feeling Andrew. It's Andrew feeling Mark. But from that moment on, I can never do violence to you. I can never move to hurt you gratuitously. I can't do it. And I just sometimes, some of the things that hurt me most is like I'll pour into someone for years and then they'll get lost in a contraction. And it doesn't happen with most people, but when it does, it just blows. You're like, wow, did we never feel each other? You actually feel someone for real just once on the inside. You actually feel them. You can never do violence to them.
Yeah. It occurs to me that you only do violence to an image, you know, of, in a sense.
Right. Right. That's why idolatry is a graven image. It's a frozen image. And the healing of idolatry is imagination, where I use the quality of imagination to be inside of you. So how does the prophet enter the divine? Through, as Ibn Arabi points out, right, the great Sufi mystic, right, through koach hamedameh, the power of imagination. The prophet imagines her way into the divine.
Hmm. Can you talk about that more? What you mean by the imagination?
Yeah. So when we talk about eros or love, one of the things we know that love is a feeling. It's a feeling. But that feeling is rooted in something deeper. It's rooted in perception. When I say I love you, I mean I see you. That's level one. I see you. It's not just I love you, I see you. So love is a perception, right? And perception gets infinitely deeper with time. But then the second level of love is I don't just perceive you, I don't just see you, I imagine you. I go from perception to imagination. And imagine you means, right? You know, why do we go to a movie? What's a great story do? Because story is the ontology of reality. When I enter into a story for a moment, I can actually feel the character. The Greeks called that catharsis, right? I have a catharsis. I actually merge with the character and I feel what they feel, right? So to be able to actually enter in and feel, right? I can enter in and feel like there you are. You're living in your house in this place and this is your context and this is how you feel when you get up in the morning, because I imagine myself into you, right? So for example, I watch Superman, the movie Superman. So I can, for a moment, I have this feeling like, oh, I can feel Superman in me. I can imagine for a second, right? Because the, right, what it'd be like to be a superhero, and then I let it go. So I kind of, when you're a kid, you walk out of a superhero movie kind of, you know, doing superhero moves, right? Because that's what you do. Because you can imagine it, it lives in you. So intimacy, there's an intimacy, interior science intimacy equation that we've articulated in cosmotic humanism. But the second dimension of the equation and the second part of the equation is mutuality of pathos. We feel each other, but we feel each other means I feel you feeling me. So the first level of intimacy is I feel you, you feel me. But the second level of intimacy is I feel you feeling me. And you feel me feeling you. And then the third level of intimacy is I feel you feeling me feeling you. So in Buddhism, they do it with like awareness. I'm aware of awareness. I'm aware of the awareness that I'm awareness, right? Which is all good. But the interior of awareness is eros, is feeling. So I feel Andrew. And then I feel Andrew feeling Mark. Andrew feels Mark. Then he feels Mark feeling Andrew. Right? All human rights are encrypted, right, in that field of intimacy. That's what the divine does. That's what it means to be God. To be God's not some dumb new age idea. And people say, I'm God. They just say, okay, relax, everybody. Stop being God. Just relax. Take it easy. Easy. Down, down. No, to be God means, I mean, when we get this, like, is that she has this capacity to feel every human being and every animal and every all of reality because she is every human being and every reality. So the reason I can feel you is because ultimately we're both utterly unique and yet we participate in a shared identity. That's why intimacy, shared identity. So Andrew thinks he has shared identity with Mrs. Andrew. And I won't say her name because I don't know Mrs. Andrew's first name, right? But there's Mr. and Mrs. Andrew, right? I apologize to Mrs. Andrew for the, right? But actually there's also Mark and Andrew. We have shared identity for real. We actually have shared identities. So the fact that the Andrew was born in a different place and Mark was born in a different place and we have different life histories, that's true. And we should be unique, but we also have actual shared identity. So I can actually say, if you'll let me, wow, your joy can be my joy. And maybe your pain can be my pain. And then I begin to expand that. I begin to say, wow, it's wider and wider and wider. I become home more and more. And I become the new human, right? I become the incarnation of the field of feeling in which there's no one who's outside of the field of intimacy. Right? It's like,
why the maybe?
Give me the last sentence.
Well, you said maybe I could feel your pain.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe if, and maybe meaning if you let me. You know, I was just wondering, if you let me, if you allow me to, right? I could feel your pain. Right. And it's, and the maybe was just to respect, right, the boundary of Andrew that has to give Mark permission. Right. But it's God doesn't ask permission. We have to ask permission to enter that deeply into another person. But the truth is we should always all have permission. Right? We should always all have permission because, you know, Heidegger, the essence of Heidegger, I read Heidegger when I was 18. He's fucking unreadable and he's also crazy beautiful and he's also crazy corrupt, right? But the essence of Heidegger is, right, is that you cannot traverse the chasm that separates two separate self-individuals. Cannot be done. Right, that loneliness and alienation is the ultimate state of reality, right? And it cannot be traversed. And there's enormous beauty in Heidegger, but in the end, he couldn't overcome that. He couldn't transcend it, right? So Jung could. So Jung becomes a Nazi for a couple of weeks and says "fuck this" and gets out. And Heidegger, you know, kind of, you know, stays in, right? Tragically, right? He just. In the end, there's no such thing as actually dissociation. We do share identity. were ever already intimate. And it's only the intimate universe that responds to the meta crisis. And intimacy is the nature of who we are. And it's our only joy. It's our only true joy. It's our only true joy. And it's, and in that joy, all is self-evidently good. Right? Like, wow, it's actually true. It's actually true. And it's an unimaginable. Maybe we can, if it's okay, just for a moment, we can just maybe just chant for a moment, just so we can be here. Is that okay?
Sure.
And let's just, everyone, if you're on mute, just so you can chant from your place, just stay on mute and just so you can, we can chant together. And in, hey, 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 ho. Hey, 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 ho, ho, ho. Hey, na, hey, ho, 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 ho. Hey, na, hey, 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 ho, ho, ho. Hey, na, na, hey, 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 ho, 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 ho. Hey, na, hey, la, hey, 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 hey. Hey, de, da, hey, 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 ho, ho, ho. Hey, 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 ho, ho, ho. Hey, de, da, hey, 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 ho, 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 ho. Hey, da, hey, 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 ho, ho, ho. Hey, de, da, hey, 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 ho, ho, ho. And I lie, hey, 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 na, 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 hey, hey, ho. Hey, da, hey, la, 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 hey, hey, ho. Hey, na, 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 hey, hey, ho, ho, ho. Hey, da, hey, la, 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 hey, hey, ho.
It's funny, I'm supposed to be giving an interview here and I don't even feel like speaking.
It's so good. It's so good. It's so good.
Because there's a kind of formality to an interview that gets broken, and then how do you get back to the blah 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 of the formality? It sort of seems absurd,
right? Doesn't it? Right? Yeah, right. It's like when we're actually in the inside together, No words. Right. And that's, but it's not silence of absence. It's like so full. And then there's a place we get to talk from there. We just could say, oh my God, I love you. Right. Like, oh my God, like madly. Right. And you just like, and it just like it's hard actually at this moment. And this is maybe the last thing, you know, on my side, we can close here, but just like, it's actually hard to even look at you now because your face is so radiant. So I'm almost, it's so alive. Like, I feel like we're so on the inside. It's like, right? Right. And here we are, right? So Nietzsche was right. All the words need to be exploded. And he intuited this place.
Mm-hmm.
Not empty.
Yeah.
Cha. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Everyone, thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Andrew. I just love how we're ending this call. It's like Shabtai just broke the formality of the interview and just like came through the call and just gave us a transmission here. Thank you so much, both of you. All right, darlings. See you next month, first Sunday of the month. Thank you, everyone, for being here. And we'll see you
next time.
Bye.